8:15 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour. The Park City Planning Commission met last night, taking up the topic of treasure once again, as well as the Alice Claim subdivision. In the studio with a recap, I have Park City Planning Commissioner Steve Joyce. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
So the applicants for treasure didn't present their findings for the traffic study that they had completed in February, but promised to have them for next month. Since they didn't have all of the plans last night, I mean, how is that sitting with the Planning Commission? Because they didn't have the other reports that you were hoping for as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit frustrating that we're trying to get things moving along, both from our standpoint, because it's using up a tremendous amount of time for the Planning Department, the Planning Commission, but also from the applicant's standpoint. I mean, we've been at this for a long while. They've mentioned that they're looking for a vote sometime like October, and we've got a lot left to do. So
they haven't formally, though, requested that vote, have they?
No. In fact, once they do that, I think it's a 45-day time clock. So if they requested it now, I mean, so you kind of can't request it now for October. You know, you can say that's our goal, that's what we're looking. And that's what they said was, in September, we will ask for it in October.
Yeah. Well, the exhibits that they did show to the commission to demonstrate how they are going to mitigate sound weren't to scale. In fact, nothing they showed was to scale. So, I mean, how do you even consider these?
Some of it you don't really need scale. I mean, the things with sound, the important things are how far away is it? And they had there were some questions about some of the distances between the nearest houses and the area that would be creating the sound. A lot of times it's like an outdoor plaza or something like that. So they represent the distance, and that's the important thing, is both distance horizontally and vertically. But they were able to show us a number of things like these kind of glass sound barriers that you have that are kind of nice. You put them around a plaza, you can see through them, but they're actually like double-layer, double-pane glass that really cuts down a tremendous amount of the noise. Same kind of thing, they showed us some metal frames that you can either use on the side of a building, or you can put up, like, if you have air conditioners and things like that, or generators or something up on top of a roof, you can kind of build these as walls. And they do the same thing. They cut down a tremendous amount of the noise. I mean, these are special baffling panels. So they were able to demonstrate a number of things. We still had a lot of questions. You could kind of tell that, I mean, they were on path to do the traffic piece, and then weren't able to. They just didn't have what they needed to do. So this was kind of things we needed to get to, but it felt more like kind of at some level unprepared filler. It was stuff they had done back in 2009 that was a good first step, but that's all it was.
Yeah. I was going to mention that the drawings that you saw were from 2009, and I think it was Commissioner Susser who had said that lots of homes have been built since then. So again, is this even relevant?
I'll stick with it was a good first cut. And so we told them, they were very good last night about what do you want to see. And this was for landscaping. This was for noise. There's a whole lot of things that they have to mitigate for the kind of the surrounding neighborhoods, lighting, fencing, things like that. And they kind of gave us enough to get started. But more than anything, it triggered a whole series of questions from the Planning Commission. And they were very good about, you know, what do you want to see? What information do you need? You know, how do you want us to address this? And again, that's fine, but we're just, you know, at some level the clock's ticking, and it's just it feels like we got a tremendous amount to do over the next 6 months.
Yeah, back to those sound baffles that you were talking about in the glass walls. Something the Kimball Arts Center may consider then, because that was also a concern with them, right?
Actually, they've already been talking about that even before we brought it up with the Planning Commission. They were already talking about. We kind of made sure that anything they did on the roof was set back. Of course, this has been remanded back to the Planning Commission, so we'll see this again. But they were already working on things like sound panels along the outside of the roof area. And so I think they were certainly trying to be considerate of the neighborhood. And it really is impressive to see how much, because we actually got to see some of the kind of marketing statistics for, you know, how much you can cut back on the sound with some of these panels and things. And it's impressive.
During public comment, the attorney for Think, Nikki DeForge, pointing out that this isn't the first time the applicant has come to Planning Commission without the information, you know, that was to be discussed. And she pointed out that it impacts the public's ability to give meaningful comments and participate. Is there anything you guys can do about that? Or you just have to be patient, huh?
I think the answer is we all have to be patient with each other. And by that, I mean the Planning Commission, the applicant, and the public. This is a big, complex, difficult project. And it's not just going to, you know, go like kind of a cookie cutter thing that we normally see. So far, we've been extremely careful about making sure that the public has all the opportunities for input they can. There's nothing that says that if you weren't quite ready to talk about screening and noise and all that kind of stuff for this meeting, well, guess what? Next month, we'll be having another treasure meeting and you can bring that up then. So the only concern would be if we came together right at the end and we're trying to make a rushed decision somehow. And I don't see that happening.
But any concern that it's really a waste of time and taxpayer dollars even, you know, and time for the public who take the time to show up when there's no meaningful discussion?
Yeah, but that's a little bit misleading. There was meaningful discussion. Mm-hmm. One of the things we have to do, we have a whole set of criteria that we have to do for a conditional use permit. Mostly what we've been focused on so far is what I think of as kind of the big scary ones, you know, the size of the buildings and the amount of commercial space and the parking and traffic is certainly one that has everyone on edge. But we have to get through, you know, screening and fencing and lighting and signage and open space requirements and all that stuff. We have to get through that to finish the CUP process. So, yeah, we just got a good start on it last night for those.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about the comment that was made that the original master plan stipulates that setbacks be 100 feet from the road, not the nearest home. So is there confusion about what the code requires here?
It's not a question of what's in the code. It's a question of what's in the master plan. And that was the first time I had heard that last night. And I know talking to Commissioner Susser next to me, she's like, do you remember reading that? And it's like, well, no, I'll go back and look at that again. So it was an interesting point that she brought up. I haven't gone back to verify it. A lot of times things are in kind of a narrow context and you have to decide, you know, does it really apply or not? And some things have been moved around on the Hill because of negotiations with the Planning Commission. So trying to set things kind of back into the gulch more, trying to make a nicer transition from houses as you have kind of these smaller houses up the hillside, kind of putting the bigger, taller ones towards the back. So part of the changes to the plan over the years, this has been going on for so long now, have been really as negotiations with the Planning Commission. And even if they had shifted something closer to a road or something like that, it would be important to go back and say, was that actually part of an agreement that was made with a past commission?
Turning to Alice Clay and the Planning Commission, you approved what here? Just access to the property without having to build those three 10-foot tall retaining walls?
Yeah, there were two things that we approved. No, we didn't approve. One thing we had a positive recommendation forwarded to City Council was for the actual subdivision plat. And realistically, that changed almost none last night. The other piece, though, was we had done a conditional use permit for this retaining wall for their entryway. And we had expressed a lot of interest and had a lot of discussions in our Planning Commission meetings about there's already a road leading up right into the subdivision, but it's owned by one of the homeowners up there. And the city has an easement across it, but the applicant was unable to get an easement. We encouraged them, even once we approved that entryway, to keep negotiating with the homeowner. And the good news is, and they did, and they have an easement. And so now there's a much nicer entrance for those who have been up there. If you just kind of look at the dirt road, imagine the dirt road becoming a little bit wider and paved.
So did it take some strong arming from the city legal department, or was it just that the owner just decided it benefited everybody?
I think, you know, I wasn't part of the negotiations. There's certainly no strong arming from the city. It was, you know, our part was kind of done. It was off to City Council to see. But I think what it became was a question of, would I, as a homeowner, you know, I can get some money from selling an easement to these people. And yeah, I'll have this road right in front of me, but I already kind of have the dirt road right in front of me, versus having this big retaining wall and yet another road in front of me. I think it's kind of everybody won, and that's what we were hoping we would see.
A little reminiscent of what we got going in Empire Pass with 224 and
yep.
Twisted Branch.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's see. What about any concerns after, and I hadn't heard this before, in the report this week about the city's public utilities department, a bit concerned that they may not be able to even provide water to Alice Claim. Was that discussed at all?
Just a little bit. It actually kind of caught me off guard because I thought we'd gone through engineering reports and stuff saying that they had adequate water supply and adequate water pressure for both the houses and for fire suppression. And that was back when we first saw plans that had the houses up on the hillside. We didn't want to see houses up on the hillside, so we actually worked with the applicant and eventually got the houses put down, and they now call it the gully plan. So they're down lower, and so good news is you're not kind of tearing up the hillside to put in houses, but that actually should give them more water pressure. So I'm not quite sure what's gone on there, but the answer is there's a condition in there that before they can actually start doing any building, they have to work with the city and make sure they have adequate pressure.
And then concerns from the sewer district then also resolved?
Yeah, that has to get resolved. Hasn't been. A lot of these things, you know, as the processes have changed now, we would require some more of this to get done early. As the plans have changed, it's now that the entryway has moved, well, they were going to run the sewer lines along the old road that had the big retaining walls. Well, now they're not. So now it's under an easement, and there's, you know, just issues about where you put sewer lines under a road or next to a road. And I don't think there was any big red flag. It was just, hey, this hasn't been resolved. It has to be resolved before you can start doing anything.
All right. Anything else from yesterday's meeting?
No, there were a couple of little things on there, but there's always a couple of little things on there.
Okay. Steve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Park City Planning Commissioner Steve Joyce. The summer changes in the Park City downtown parking are coming. A parking community forum was held yesterday afternoon. Another is planned for this morning at 9 a.m. at the Park City Library. In the studio, I have Julie Dixon. She's the principal consultant with Dixon Resources, who is managing these changes, along with Kenzie Colson, Park City's parking and fleet manager. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So where are we in the process of implementing this new system?
So we've actually gone to City Council with the recommended vendor that's going to be the prime contractor that's going to oversee the technical deliverables associated with the hardware that's going to be installed and the software that's going to manage it. Currently, the vendor is here in Park City, and we're currently walking through the facilities, walking through the job sites, sitting down with the vendor and talking about all of the technical aspects of the deliverables. And now we'll really get into the fine-tuning of all of the different aspects of parking, the hours of operation, the rates, and that's part of where the stakeholder meetings are so relevant, because we're actually taking the feedback from the community and really applying that to the next steps, which is trying to basically influence the policy.
Yeah. So can you give us an idea of what we might see? I mean, we're talking about perhaps putting gates at the entrances to China Bridge, perhaps a gate at the flagpole parking lot, but maybe not because we don't have enough room. I mean, can you give us an idea?
Of course. So at the garage, we're looking at a full makeover for the China Bridge garage. Everything from paint to signs to also what we'll call infrastructure, which are gate arms and basically pay on foot machines, so that way it'll basically be an access control system on the garage. But you're going to see a whole makeover from the paint, the signage, and the signage is really important because the garage can be somewhat confusing the way that it's been added onto, and so we're really trying to simplify that along with the wayfinding. You're going to see a whole new signage campaign that's going to come into the city that's going to help direct people so that they can find available parking. And what's also going to happen is there's going to be a guidance system in the garage to show you where available parking spaces are in the garage and even what entrance to go to so that you can find the most accessible parking in the garage. Now, for the Gateway Garage, that's actually a little bit of a tricky facility, and it's only because of the design. Kenzie calls it a dogleg, and I think that's a really good example of how that garage is designed. There's really not a turnaround, so we're really trying to look at what we can do with the Gateway Center Garage to really make it optimal. We're looking at maybe creating a priority type of permit, maybe for folks that carpool potentially, and making that maybe a really desirable location where we put people with permits in that particular location. That hasn't been decided yet because we're really trying to look at how to maximize that facility, make it very customer friendly, make it accessible. Potential that there could be gate arms, but that hasn't been decided yet. And at all of the surface lots, we're going to end up having counting systems so that we're going to be able to identify how many parking spaces are available at those locations. And in addition, there's going to be brand new pay stations installed throughout the city, so including on Main Street and basically all along, you'll see brand new parking pay stations, so it'll make it easy for folks to basically pay and do their transactions at. And there will also be a mobile payment solution that comes in with all of this so that you'll be able to complete all of your parking transactions using your mobile phone. But I really have to highlight the really big important part of this is kind of the parking brand as well as the outreach and also the wayfinding. That's a really big component of all of this is we're trying to make it very easy to park and to find parking in Park City. And this also ties in with the park and rides and a lot of the things that Kenzie and the team are really working on is to try to identify the remote parking, being able to identify how to park there, where to park there, when to park there, how to get to downtown from those locations. That's all of the details that we're really kind of rolling our sleeves up on, as well as the improvements to the bus system to increase, you know, frequency of the busing and being able to get from the park and rides to downtown as well. The last thing I just really want to add is the employees. It's been heard loud and clear, the concern about the employees and making sure that they can get to work on time, that it's easy and accessible. And I have to say that city staff are working very diligently to look at the solutions associated with that.
All right. So when we talk about employees, are we talking about MARSAC building employees as well?
Oh, everyone, basically. Pretty much anyone that works in Park City, I think, is really affected by this. And so we're looking at ways to try to simplify the process for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Because certainly the MARSAC building has had that north lot as well as the, well, the front lot for business, but the back lot, north lot for employees. So that means, I mean, would we see a parking gate up there as well or...
So at all of the surface lots, we aren't anticipating putting any kind of access control systems because it's really meant to be a free flow system. But one of the things that we shared at the stakeholder meetings, as well as that we've talked to city staff, is no one is exempt from this policy. Whether you're a city employee, whether you're a downtown employee, whatever the case may be, the policies apply across the board. And so everyone will be affected. The same conversations that we've had with key stakeholders and residents are the same conversations we've had with city staff, as we're looking at carpooling, vanpooling, ride shares, whatever we can do to try to minimize those single occupancy vehicle travels.
Yeah, when you talk about counting systems, I mean, what do you have, sensors in the roads or something? I mean, how do you know?
Great question. What it typically is, they're called ground deduction loops. You actually, when you're sitting in a traffic signal, you're usually sitting on a loop. And that's very simply what it really comes down to. Most of the systems are based on in-ground counters, so vehicle in, vehicle out. It's pretty simple, pretty standard technology. There's a possibility that at some of the locations there might end up being single space sensors in some of the actual parking spaces, but it really will come down to design of that actual location. But what it really is meant to do is identify if there's available parking at that location.
And then kind of like the electronic signs we see at the resorts that show which lifts and chair lifts and runs are open.
Exactly. The one thing that we absolutely have to keep in mind, though, is the historical preservation guidelines. So when we talk about any of that signage, especially digital signage, we have to make sure that it really ties into the aesthetic of the community. And that's something that's really a key concern and a key aspect of what we're doing moving forward as well.
As I mentioned, you did hold a meeting yesterday. Did you get a good turnout for that?
We did. We were just talking. I think there was about 40 folks at that meeting. We had a meeting also last month where both meetings were standing room only. And we have another meeting this morning at 9 o'clock at the library. And it's actually been very interactive. And I have to say, I mean, you know, people are passionate when it comes to parking. It's understandable. And I just really want to encourage people to come out and share their concerns, share their thoughts, share their ideas, too, because I have to tell you that everything is considered and everything's really tying in. Yesterday, we had some folks who brought up some really great points. And it's all things that we have to consider because, you know, I don't live here. And to be able to hear the outside feedback from folks, we can really tie that into our objectives.
What were some of the things that you heard that you'll take back with you?
So yesterday in particular, we learned a lot more about the folks that live on, I'll call it the bottom side of Park Avenue, and the impacts that we're having of the folks that live down by the school and by the library, and the fact that a lot of employees are parking down there, basically capturing the bus, and also skiers that are parking there and that are going up to the resorts. And I had not personally, I know Kenzie gets to hear this all the time, I had not heard that direct impact. We know that parking changes in downtown are going to have an effect and they tend to spread out to the surrounding communities. But to hear some of the residents come directly and speak about the challenges of people blocking their driveways, people parking in their driveways, things like that, it was just, it really resonated. And so we already started to talk about strategies and policy changes that might be able to help benefit those particular aspects of the community too. So
maybe, Kenzie, something like we already see with, you know, Upper Park Avenue, where people are required to have a parking permit?
Absolutely. And Julie's correct. What we heard yesterday was overwhelming support for a residential program north of 12th Street. Our current program ends right at 12th and park, basically. And I believe that there's an increase in congestion and parking, largely resort overflow north of 12th Street. So that is part of our roadmap, and we'll be moving toward that residential area program as well.
Yeah, take it all the way down to the Cole and Jan's intersection.
That's
what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, or anything else that you wanted to share from what you heard from
there people? Was one more thing, and it was only because the city representative that coordinates the program was there, was the Vanpool program. I learned a lot about the Vanpool program and the fact that there's so many opportunities to try to take advantage of this program. I learned about the Vanpools that are coming in from Heber, and it's costing the participants in that program $50 a month to participate in this van share, and I just thought that that was amazing. And to know that there's resources available so that other groups from other areas can put together this resource and be able to take advantage of this Vanpool program through UTA, correct?
Well, I also have seen Lewis stages. I pass one of those every morning at about 6.
Yeah. I believe several local businesses facilitate their own carpools, and so I did want to mention that a part of this program is it's focused on employees and, of course, the folks in Old Town who are parking, but we'll also be reaching out to other businesses to see how they are working with the traffic congestion carpool programs. You know, we want to collaborate and we want to share this message.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about it, because we keep hearing about, oh, if we ride our bikes or we take the bus or we take a Vanpool, that we're going to be able to get some kind of credit for that so that we'll be able to use the parking garage basically free of charge if, in fact, you know, when we need to. How is that going to work?
So the incentive program is actually one of the things that we're talking about at this week's stakeholder meetings, and we're really trying to find out what type of incentive would motivate you to look at taking alternative forms of transportation and really learning from people, you know, what would it take to get you to participate in a van share? What would it take for you to maybe only drive twice a week? Those things. And we're finding out whether those be, you know, monetary rewards, whether it be free parking. And the vendor that's actually here, we're talking to them about how we'll be able to apply those credits. If you have a pass card that you tap every time you ride the bus, and then it earns points so that when you actually, you know, swipe it into the parking machine, it actually gives you those credits. Those are all factors that we're actually working on right now on how that'll work. But we anticipate that it'll most likely be an app that would be on your phone. So you would be able to use your phone and have all of that information. And then you go on there with your points to purchase prizes or whatever the case may be. But that's really the idea of how we can basically motivate folks to use the program.
Yeah, and I can see it on the bus how you can make it work. But for those of us who do ride our bikes in the summer, how's that going to work? How do you know that I'm riding my bike?
That's a really great question. I have to tell you, nobody's actually asked that granular question yet. So I'll tell you what, the next time I come back to you, I will have an answer for that. I have to think about that one a little bit more, but we'll definitely come up with a plan for that. I think it might end up being something of a commitment. You know, usually when people do programs like that, you kind of participate, you register in, and there's a level of, you know, faith or good faith, honesty about how you're going to manage it. I think that there's going to be some aspects of that, is that we're looking at people just really making that contribution and commitment. So we'll have to figure that out, but we'll come back to you with a game plan on that.
Okay, so what's going to happen from here? You've got, again, the one more meeting here in just another 15 minutes, and then what happens?
So what happens next is you're actually going to start to see more engagement with additional stakeholder groups. We're actually looking to talk to the Arts Commission about potentially utilizing their services to help with maybe some of the additions that we're going to make into the garage. You'll start to see meetings with the different stakeholders, with the signage programs that are going to be coming, so that we can start to work with our wayfinding expert. You're going to see the equipment being ordered, and from here you'll see a deliverables timeline. Once we come out of the meetings with the vendor today, we should actually be able to, within the next week or so, have an actual timeline for when infrastructure is going to be installed over the summertime.
Because the idea, Kenzie Wright, is to have this in place for, like, what, December 1?
I think that's the overwhelming target, winter. We will roll the program out late summer, pending testing, and obviously we want to get this right. So we don't want anyone to be nervous.
Okay. And again, if you have a chance to come by this morning, you'll be, what, there in the
library first floor.
Okay. Julie and Kenzie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Kimball Arts Center welcomes visiting artist Stephanie Wood, an artist who continues the native tradition of basket weaving by offering a special workshop and an art talk. In the studio to tell us more, I have Kimball Arts Center Education Specialist Jocelyn Scudder. And Stephanie Wood joins me now on the phone. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jocelyn, let's start with you. You're bringing Stephanie in to do what exactly?
Yeah, so I learned about Stephanie actually through an arts institute in California who hosted a workshop in Kalapuya basket weaving, which is Stephanie's specialty. And I was just really intrigued by the visual art aesthetic in the basket weaving. A lot of times I think weaving can be preserved as a perceived as a craft, and I think it's a really true, beautiful visual art form. And we actually had a lot of requests for more fiber arts weaving from the community. So this was a way that we were trying to really listen to the community. And I saw this postcard actually that came to the Kimball, and I said, we have to have Stephanie come. So we're thrilled to have her.
Okay. And so she's coming when, and what's going to happen while she's here?
Yep. She's coming April 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. So not this weekend, but the next weekend, right? The start of mud season. I know there's not a lot to do. And we're offering three workshops for three different age groups. So there's a kids workshop on Friday, a family workshop on Saturday, and then a more advanced workshop for adults that carries over both on Saturday morning and Sunday morning. And each workshop offers something different. So the kids have an experience to make something a little more simple, something they can really handle, which is a cedar mat weaving. And then adults and kids together on Saturday morning get to make a Kalapuya cattail mat weaving during the workshop. And then during the adult workshop for on Saturday and Sunday, the adults get to make a Western red cedar basket and a coastal sweetgrass sedge basket weaving. And Stephanie can probably talk to you a little bit more about the natural materials that she's using and why.
Okay. And then how much does this cost?
So they all vary. The family class is $80 per child and adult pair, so it's essentially $40 per student, and each member of the family gets to walk away with something that they made. This children's workshop on Friday is $75, and the adult workshop is $100, but there is a $50 material fee as they're using a lot of really beautiful natural materials from Stephanie.
Okay, and is she also going to be doing an art talk?
She is not going to be doing an art talk, but she will be talking about the special cultural traditions and how she's carrying on those traditions as a kind of young Native American tribal member. She really thinks it's a part, you know, of her job to help educate and document their cultural heritage traditions. So she's leading the way, and we're excited to have her.
Okay. Stephanie, I'll bring you into the conversation now here. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and the art of basket weaving.
Well, I'm 33, and I'm a seventh-generation basket weaver. On my mom's side, my mom's Native American, my father is white, and I've been weaving roughly 15 to 17 years using all traditional plants, local plants, materials, and using traditional weaving techniques that have been used for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, so it's something that you did learn from your mother?
Not from my mother. So when she was growing up on the reservation, assimilation had taken full effect. And so it wasn't, at her time growing up, it wasn't safe to practice or speak the language, practice traditions. So she didn't grow up learning to weave, but my grandmother did, and she's actually going to be 103 on the 19th.
Wow.
And so she, we grew up with baskets being passed down, and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and learning stories and about places where she would gather and how she would do it, and very, very fortunate for that.
Yeah, so why did you decide to make this something? I mean, I'm guessing you do it full time now and make a living at it.
I do. So I was in college and I was finishing up my master's degree. And for my master's, I did a basketry project on Women Weave Western Oregon. It's Oregon in like the Native American community, at least on the west side. Everyone knows about California Indian culture, basketry, language, foods. Washington's known for plank houses, language, basketry. Oregon's kind of in between, kind of a lost area. So I wanted to bring more attention to the art form. And you know, we are here, we are still practicing, and it's important that people still see that and still know that.
Yeah.
So I I don't look Native American. I'm very, very light skin, blue eyes, light hair. And so I get kind of the, wait, you're a basket weaver? You can, you know your tradition. You can weave. You can speak your language. So it's important for people to see that, you know, we all come in different shades.
Yeah. So the baskets themselves, I mean, range as a lot like clay pottery, huh? I mean, just it depends on the person? Or are there very standard kind of basket shapes?
So when the material is gathered, it's living. It's got energy in it, and then I'm putting energy. There's like a transfer of energy when we go and gather the materials. So every person, and we as Native Americans believe, you know, every person is individual, and nothing is the same, nothing is perfect. So the transfer of, you know, spiritual, emotional energy that is going through from the weaver to the materials into the basket, the materials will do kind of their own thing, and then the basket will all start out with the same shape or idea, but when everyone's done with their own basket, their own personality and traits will come out into it. Some baskets will be woven maybe a little bit tighter, you know, a little bit more structured, where others could be, you know, not as straight, more freeform.
Okay.
So it's amazing to see what comes out of everyone's projects when they're all done, because we start with exactly everything the same for everyone.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, Jocelyn, when or how do people register?
They can go to our website, KimballArtCenter.org, and all the registration is online, and we do recommend you register in advance for these workshops. And, yeah, we hope everybody comes to the Art Center next weekend and enjoys Stephanie. We are thrilled to have her.
All right, Jocelyn Scudder and Stephanie Witt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Well, the season is over for the members of the Park City Ski Team. In the studio with a wrap-up, I have Program Director Jesse Hunt. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's run through some of the season highlights. What can you tell us?
Well, I just want to begin by saying that we just finished our season yesterday. We had some great races over in Snowbird and wrapped up the season for us. It was a great finale, beautiful weather, just a great day, great celebration of the sport, and it was really fun to get a number of different levels of our program racing together at the same time. And we had some alumni there as well. Sam Duprat, who's now skiing for the University of Utah, was over there supporting the kids racing. Andrew Miller, who's now with the U.S. Ski Team, he was out racing. And then, of course, our Park City Ski Team kids were out there, a number of different levels, different age groups, U14 and up. So it was really a fun event and a great way to end the season.
So, okay. And what can you tell us about the rest of the season?
Well, we had a lot of great snow here and a lot of great training. We had this in the month of March. We have a number of different championships, and we had athletes in the East racing at the Junior Nationals, U16 Nationals. Claire Thomas had some great results out there at the Junior Nationals. She was second for the U19s and fourth overall junior and at that series, which was great. U16 level at the Nationals, we had Bryn Hitchcock and Max Miller representing the Park City Ski Team. Bryn was second in the slalom out there. Max was fourth in the GS, fifth in the Super G. So some top national results for us from some of our kids at those different age groups, which is always a good barometer for us to kind of, you know, see where we are nationally. And then at the younger groups, it's regional type events and divisional type events. And we had some great results at those levels as well, at the U14s and U12s. And it was really fun this year to host the Intermountain Division Championships, which is a U12 race. We hosted that here at Park City. And had a lot of fun. There was a slalom, a giant slalom, and a dual race. Had a lot of participation from our membership there, and at the U12 and U10 levels, and some really great results there as well. So, you know, we're excited. We had a great season for a number of reasons. You know, just athletically, and having fun up on the mountain. So. It was really a great year for us.
Yeah. So are these U age levels working for everybody? Just when I learned the junior numbers, now we've gone to the U, but just to try and be more like every other sport.
Well, there was a realignment a few years ago, and so the nomenclature changed from the junior four, junior five, to the U12, U10. And it really hasn't changed a whole lot in terms of what we're doing out there on the hill. It's really just, you know, labeling and names and really categorizing the different age groups. And we did change the racing levels by 1 year, and that's really what drove that change in nomenclature. And that happened probably 3 years ago now. So we're well into that, and everyone has adopted that and getting used to it. But as I said, it really doesn't change what we're doing. So.
Yeah, and I know at the lower levels with U-Ski League and South Series races, I mean, you get so many racers that it's really hard to even pull off two races. So there's some talk about some changes there as well.
Well, you know, that's an exciting thing too. I mean, we have a terrible problem. We have so many kids that love to alpine ski race that we're having a hard time accommodating everybody. I mean, what a cool problem to have. We have on the Wasatch Front, there's a number of different programs, and you know, it's alive and well, our sport, and we're now trying to organize ourselves so that the races are more efficient, and we're doing a better job at delivering the events. So we'll probably make some changes at those younger levels between the U Ski League and the U12 races, which are called South Series races. That's defining the southern part of the division. That's why they're called South Series. And we have, as I said, we have so many kids now. It's a matter of organizing in a way where we're just delivering great events. So, yeah.
And with the change in ownership from Powder to Vail Resorts, too, I think it's also opened up the training area then to more than just the Park City Ski Team. Is that been a problem for you at all? Or?
Well, we're training with a number of different teams up here. I mean, it's probably one of the most active training venues really in the country. We have 9 different teams that are busy training here. So, you know, the resort's very active. They're supporting the alpine racing and training. So it's a matter of working in with all the other teams and coordinating everything and making it happen for our team.
So it's more of a scheduling issue than anything.
Yeah. And we've moved things around. We have training all day long. We have training from 9 in the morning till 9 at night on Tuesdays and Thursdays, to give an example. So there's a lot of different training blocks, and everybody's trying to utilize the venue as best we can.
Yeah. So from this season, I mean, we've got kids headed to college ski teams, and you mentioned Andrew on the development team of USSA and...
Yes.
Any others?
It is a fun time of year, because now we're going to celebrate our kids at our awards banquet next Friday. But, you know, just to give people a preview, you know, we've got kids moving into college now. Claire Thomas is going to Dartmouth. She's moving into that next season. And then we have a number of kids who are going to college and raise Division I in Alpine. And that they're at Colby, they're at UNH, they're at St. Lawrence, they're... you know, a number of different schools. And so we have 6 or 7 kids who are graduating out this year, and a lot of them are on that track, skiing in Division I next year. So we're excited about that.
Okay. And then let's quickly just mention the Park City Ski Team hosts the Town Race Series. Did you get some turnout for it?
Yeah, we do. We do. We have a really enthusiastic, hardcore group that comes out. We had 4 events this year. It was well attended on, you know, there's roughly 100 skiers that come out on any given night. And we had our winners this year were actually 2 Park City Ski Team coaches. Will McDonald won on the men's side, and Jess Kelly won on the women's side for the season. But what I really like to share is we have, you know, 4 categories of awards, so it's really something for everyone. We have some amazing skiers there, but we also have some first-timers out there, and so that's a nice mix, and it's been a really fun series to host.
All right, so you'll do it again next year?
We're looking forward to it.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Well, you know, I just appreciate, you know, everything that's been going on in the community supporting what we're doing. You know, I think obviously we have a large membership and a great following after all these years, and I just appreciate all the support we get in the community.
Okay, Jesse, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Leslie.
Jesse Hunt with Park City Ski Team. You're listening to